Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So before we get started, we've actually got a special offer for Reconsider listeners. Now, as you guys know, Xander and I love the great works of philosophy, political theory, and literature throughout the ages. We both think that it's been foundational in our understanding of politics throughout history and today. So our special offer today is for those who are interested in developing a habit of reading classic books by authors such as Homer, Nietzsche, Cicero, Spinoza, and more. To do that, you can go to onlinegreatbooks.com.
OnlineGreatBooks.com is designed to help you develop a regular habit of reading the great books.
Weekly reading goals, reading reminders, accountability tools, and a dedicated community of fellow readers help you keep on track and on schedule with your reading.
The OnlineGreatBooks.com check-in and reading goal system is designed to help you progress through the great books with just 3 one-hour reading sessions each week.
And every month, OnlineGreatBooks.com ships a carefully selected edition of one of the great books directly to your home. They begin with Homer and progress through works like Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Shakespeare, and up through the moderns.
Each month, you'll meet in a two-hour video conference to discuss your text with a small community of readers in a Socratic seminar led by a trained Socratic host.
So go to OnlineGreatBooks.com to join the VIP list, and you'll receive for free an executive book summary, a digest of the reading list, and more.
If you're interested in developing a lifelong habit of reading and studying the great books, go to OnlineGreatBooks.com and do please enter the promo code REC to get 25% off your first 3 months. Again, that promo code is REC.
Hey. All right, cool.
All right.
I don't know what that is.
The restart reload worked like it does every time. I don't even know why anyone has an IT company. How are you going to restart it?
Just restart, close it out, shake it a little bit if it's not working.
Blow on it. Old Nintendo, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, great. Now we've just revealed exactly, the precise fact that all of us were born in the 1980s.
Oh, man. I have you beat, actually. I have you beat a little bit.
Okay, you're a Gen Xer. But yeah,
still Pong, I think. But yeah, you got to take the cartridge out, right? And then you got to shake it, and then you got to blow it and put it right back in.
Let's just do that with the economy.
Yeah, well.
Just take it out.
Well,
yeah, totally works.
Just blow on it a little
blow
bit.
Blow on it.
Shake it.
Yeah, that's something that has to be explained very carefully to our younger listeners.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, just blow it and it'll be fine. They're like, oh
yeah.
Mark,
I had at one point I told a group of students that this, I was showing them a complicated graph. I was like, it's kind of like Legend of Zelda where you have to make your decisions to go through, and I got like 40 confused looks. And I was like, oh,
what?
Legend of Zelda, man. It's not like Contra.
It's not like Contra. Games used to be hard, and that's how they should
well,
be.
I'm going to weave this in. So until you learn the code, right?
Right. Oh, right. Yeah.
So it's up, up, down, down, left, right, B, A, select, start, and then you've got unlimited lives. It's the
Indeed.
Only way I could beat Contra.
With hacks.
With hacks. That's what we used to call that. That's what hacking used to be.
Yeah, back in the day, man.
Back
it
in
wasn't
the, day,
the
man.
Russians trying to.
It was all Russians. It was all Russians, right? Like, wasn't Rocky IV was the Russians? I don't know what year they came out.
Yeah.
Right.
Man, no, we are old.
But it's all now. It's all cycling back. It's all just cycles. That's all it is.
Thank you.
Welcome, dear listeners, to another great episode of Reconsider, part of the Agora Podcast Network, where we don't do the thinking for you. We are continuing our series on economics today, bringing in another expert, John Schwabisch, who we'll introduce in a moment. Quick housekeeping. Agora did just launch our podcast listener forum on Facebook. So you can go search for the Agora Podcast Listener Forum. And a number of our hosts, including us, will go up there and we'll post articles we think are interesting. We'll start discussions. A lot of listeners are there talking to each other. It's actually a really great time. Come check it out. Agora Podcast Listener Forum. And now to the show. So I'd like to introduce Jonathan Schwabisch. John is a policy data visualization nerd, which means he's, of course, very dear to our hearts. His website, policyviz.com, is about how to visualize policy data really well and why that's important. And I happen to think it's very important. He's an economist by training, and his big thing is communicating policy and economics more clearly to real people because we live in a democracy. He spent 9 years at the Congressional Budget Office and is currently a senior fellow at the Urban Institute's Income and Benefits Policy Center and Communication Team. He has a book called Better Presentation, A Guide for Scholars, Researchers, and Wonks that I wish I had read when I was working on my master's thesis, and he got his PhD from Syracuse. We will link to all of his really cool stuff that you should go read in the show notes. And if the words Urban Institute sound familiar, that's because we also just recently had Dr. Marin from the same place.
Yes, and today, per his specialty, John Schwabisch is going to help us get a better understanding of the tax bill that was just passed in late 2017. And obviously, it's a very complicated bill. It has come up sort of in passing or tangentially in this economic series that we've been doing, but it has generally just been either poorly communicated or not communicated in a comprehensive way, therefore misinterpreted, misunderstood, or just hard to hit all the bullets. So we're going to try to give that tax bill a somewhat more rounded perspective. So, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
The recent tax bill passed by the GOP was marketed as something that would supercharge growth, help the middle class, and boost worker pay. Trump commonly called it the biggest tax cut in a generation. It was sold actually both as a tax cut and as tax reform more generally, the latter implying that the important part is less about the money in your pocket and more about a change in the incentives that the tax system has. And by doing this, the bill is meant to create incentives for people to be more economically productive here in the United States. That was the idea. It's also been blasted as a giveaway to the rich, a giveaway to corporations, apparently also GOP donors. It's been blasted as a budget buster and just bad news generally. It was also a bill that was hacked together pretty fast. So we often didn't really know it was in it at each iteration as it changed. So the public was not very well informed and it was unpopular when it passed. So polling, it didn't do all that well. So that's largely what most people know. And John's going to help us out a little bit. So John, my first question for you is, you know, one thing I think that was really interesting about the conversation was for, you know, for those who both supported it and didn't like it, they mostly talked about the personal income tax cuts and not the corporate tax cuts. And, you know, I want to get your thoughts on why that might have been or what the consequences are. But I do generally like, you know, when talking about the tax bill with people, I like breaking into two parts, income and corporate, because I think they're really different beasts. And I'm wondering if you agree with that. And if you don't, why not? And is there any other big category of what was in the tax bill other than those two things, income and corporate?
I mean, I think that's the right way to think about it in those two grand buckets. There's a lot of other things going on. There was some treatment from the Affordable Care Act that was in there. There was some issue, some treatment of what happens with sole proprietorships and small businesses, treating them as pass-throughs where you basically, you know, person like me who are, you know, a sole proprietor maybe getting 1099s and you treat yourself more as a corporation. So there's those sorts of things that sort of balance or blend between the two. But I think thinking about it in these two buckets is probably the right way to do it because there were really big changes in both of those sides. On the corporate side, of course, the big thing that happened was cutting the corporate tax rate down to 21% from 35%, which is just a tremendous change. And something that I think, you know, probably people on both sides of the aisle think is in general cutting the corporate tax rate. I think in general, probably most people would agree with. The question, of course, whenever you pass tax reform or pass tax cuts is how do you make up the lost revenue? And in the case of this bill, that was not really part of the story, not really part of the concern, because not only does the bill or does the law now cut the corporate tax rate, it also changed the income tax rate on the personal side and reduced a lot of those rates as well. And I think probably I think what happens is you have like the two camps of the income tax and the corporate tax. And I think that probably ends up filtering down into how things are communicated to the public. I would guess that if, you know, you're a big watcher of, you know, CNBC or headline news or something, or where the stock ticker's on there all the time, you're probably more interested in the corporate tax rate, or if you're a business owner, right? But if you're, you know, like us, right, and you're worried about what you are going to have to pay at the end of the year, what you're going to have to pay in your tax, you know, what's going to get taken out of your paycheck every month. And that's sort of a different thing. That's the personal part. That's why taxes, I think, also healthcare become such hot topics, because they are so personal to each of us, because every 2 weeks, you know, we see how much money is coming out of our pocket.
So I think the question about the corporate tax is something worth diving into a little bit more, because it was such a big cut. And the question that always comes to my mind when I think about corporate tax rates are statutory versus effective, right? Because everyone talks about 35% being the statutory rate in the US, which is, in a nutshell, just like the rate that, you know, legally needs to be charged. But of course, there are deductions you can take, non-cash expenses that you can deduct from your operating income, that effectively makes the total amount of taxes that you would pay in dollars as a percent of your operating income less. So given that, how big of a deal is this reduction in the statutory rate to 21%, given that, you know, the effective average rate in the US was already, you know, lower than 35%, and, you know, what changes from here?
It was a good question. I think it's a big change in practice for lots of businesses who maybe were not able to take advantage of some of the offshoring, where they move parts of the business overseas, or some of the other accounting mechanisms that maybe larger businesses are allowed to take advantage of. So I would suspect for a lot of businesses it's an actually major change. I think the other part about it is how we're supposed to think about the long-term effects of the change in the corporate tax rate. I mean, it is a massive change. And the optics of it, of course, are the other part of how the tax bill was sold, that, you know, I think probably business owners have a better sense of what they have to pay on their taxes. You know, probably a lot of people with their personal income taxes, they sort of have a general sense, but I know a lot of people who are like, it's sort of a guessing game at the end of the year. You know, am I going to get a refund? Am I going to have to pay? Like, what is it at the end? I think probably corporations and business owners probably have their fingers are a little bit more on the pulse, because it, you know, obviously matters to the health of their business, especially if they're a public company and they have to, respond to shareholder demands. But the optics of it that are saying, oh, look at all this money I can now save in taxes. You know, maybe I can roll this into more investment into my business. Maybe I can roll it into, passing some of those savings on to employees, for better or for worse. I think there's an optics issue there. The other thing that I think is worth talking about with the corporate tax rate is just on the optics of how the tax bill was passed. You know, one of the things that we all heard during the relatively short debate on the bill was how this was going to add, you know, there was going to be a lot of negative effects. You know, as you mentioned earlier, it's a, you know, tax cuts for the rich. You know, it's going to blow up the debt. And, you know, you had a lot of different organizations coming out with much lower, much bigger debt numbers and much lower growth numbers that are coming out of the bill than the proponents, out of the administration, out of Congress. But I think one of the responses I would have as someone who was trying to sell the bill or the law, that I really didn't hear a lot, was to say, look, all of the projections on your GDP growth or your economic growth or your debt numbers are all based on historical experience. And we haven't had a corporate tax cut of this magnitude in forever. So what you're projecting in the future, how do you square the circle where you're basing your models on historical data, but we have this massive tax cut that is just out of the realm of what we've experienced in the past. So, you know, I think there's sort of the practical part of what am I going to have to pay as a business owner? But also how is it sold to the public, I think was really interesting. And that communication side of things, is something we can talk about a little bit later, but I think the optics of it are part of what, you know, obviously, why it garnered support on one side and opposition on the other side.
I'm gonna keep digging at this because this is great. One of the things you said earlier was that, you know, generally corporate tax cuts are something that sees some support on both sides. And I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I know it's very far to one side, but I know that my experience has not been that the left around here has been supportive of corporate tax cuts. And I think one of the argument I've heard is that, hey, the corporate tax cut is being sold on, and I'm not sure this is how it was being sold, but opponents of the corporate tax cut are saying, look, the supporters of the corporate tax cut are saying that businesses need more money in their pockets to invest and to give money to employees, but business profits are higher than they've ever been. So if more profits meant, you know, more money for employees and more investment, we would have already seen it. And therefore, the entire argument for the corporate tax cut is null. Maybe we should even tax them more because their profits are so high. Is there a like more sophisticated argument in favor of corporate tax cuts than just, oh, it will give businesses more money and they'll do something with that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that's one of the selling points, right? Is that, you know, corporations make a lot of money, and so therefore they don't need a bigger tax cut. But you know, if we look at the data, the 35% corporate tax rate is by modern developed major industrialized nations. It's by far the highest. Now, I don't know what the magic number is. You know, I don't know if it's 21 or 28 or 32 or what. You know, what is the right number? I think part of the question of what the right number is what's the goal of the law, you know, and what are the outcomes of the law? Are you worried about balancing the budget? Are you worried about doing things through the personal income tax side? Are you worried about doing things with low income support programs like the earned income tax credit, you know, those sorts of things. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is that we are in a global economy, and American businesses don't just compete with other American businesses or Mexican businesses or Canadian businesses, or, you know, it's a global economy. And so, and we know this, right? The economy's gotten smaller and smaller. It's just that competition has gotten, I think, you know, more, the world has gotten smaller and smaller. And again, I don't know what the right number is, but I think also, you know, obviously there's lots of different types of businesses, but, you know, the people that I know who are the own businesses, they own, you know, they're like me, it's a one man shop, or, you know, they have five or six employees. And I'd be surprised if any of those are saying, oh yeah, we're rolling in cash right now. You know, the bigger corporations, as I think there's a view that they are rolling in money. And I think, you know, there's a recent precedent for that belief, you know, the fiscal, the financial crisis, you know, that's not, you know, we're only what, 10 years out from the financial crisis. You know, I think that exposed a lot of the excesses in the financial sector, but also the corporate sector. And I think people still feel, you know, scarred a little bit by that. And I think rightfully so. And we just saw, you know, this past week, you know, a rollback of some of the Dodd-Frank legislation that was put in place after the financial crisis to try to put some checks and balances on the financial sector. So, you know, I think there's on especially on the left, you know, in the New England states, but also here in Northern Virginia, you know, we're kind of a purple turn and blue up here. You know, there is certainly reluctance, and it's, you know, it's not all rooted in fact, which I think is, or in data, which is what we are, you know, what we're trying to get at here on on this podcast. And I think just looking at the data, that 35% was just, historically high, maybe not historically high, but certainly high relative to our partners.
Yeah, globally high.
Globally high. And again, what's the right number? I don't know, but it seems like the right number is the number that meets whatever the goal is. In this case, it seemed like, remember it was down to 20% in the early version. I think in the House version of the bill, it was down to 20%, and then it creeped back up to 21% because they wanted to hit some target of what the debt, the increase in the debt was going to be. They wanted to be just a little bit less. So, how all these things come together and how, the Congress has to follow certain rules and what they want the score to look like, what they want the final numbers to look like, all impacts that number. And again, we'll have to see what happens. The other thing we should talk about is the economy, right? The economy right now is buzzing and it's humming along. And we now have this big tax cut in the middle of a economic, low unemployment rate and decent economic growth.
I mean, you basically preempted my next question, but before I get to it, I do just want to take the opportunity on Reconsider. It is one of the first times it's come up for me to tell everyone what to think and what the right answer is, because clearly the right number is 42.
Yeah, that is right. That is true. That is the right number. However, what is the question?
I see what you did. Here's the question.
Right back to you. We'll see in a few thousand years.
So I don't have the question, but I have a question. Hopefully that'll suffice.
That was good. Okay. All right. I'm going to build a computer to go figure it out.
I mean, so you talked about the position within the current economic cycle in which we find ourselves. And this is a point that I've now heard made by several talking heads or pundits or radio interviewees, so on and so forth, that tax cuts are fine. And I've actually even heard left-leaning economists say that tax cuts can be fine as a fiscal stimulus policy. The thing is, it's nice to do fiscal stimulus when the economy needs it. Mm-hmm. And we're not in a recession. The labor market's very tight. Inflation is, not nothing. It's I think lower than the Fed would like, but it's
right.
We're not near 0%, and interest rates are still low, even though they're going up. So is this the appropriate time for fiscal stimulus? Is there salt to this argument? What do you think?
Yeah, I think there is. It obviously depends on your philosophy about what government should do and what government should be. If you believe that government should have a smaller or minimal role in people's lives, then I think you probably want to reduce taxes whenever you can, no matter if it's during an economic boom or bust. But I think, from my perspective, what you'd want to do is have an opportunity to cut taxes in a time where you want to encourage spending, where you want to sort of jumpstart the economy. And that's what we saw during the financial crisis, right? When President Obama came into office, he offered some of these short-term stimulus packages that had some of the pieces went, some of it was direct spending, but other parts of it were cuts in taxes. Some of it were small increases in benefits. For example, in the food stamp program, beneficiaries got a small bump in their benefits for a couple of years. And that's when you have a recession, that's one way that the federal government can respond to try to kickstart the economy. When the economy is doing well, when you cut taxes, then it's hard to, you're not really spurring anything in that way. And in some ways you tie your hands for what's going to happen, what happens down the road. If we turn into a recession a year from now, if we have another financial crisis, say, it's not clear to me that we can continue to cut taxes, because you put yourself in a very dangerous position when it comes to the deficit and the debt. Now, let me just come back one second to the economy doing well. I think, and I've been sort of thinking about this in a different way lately. One of the things that everybody argued about with the tax cut bill or the tax bill was, what is economic growth is great. Economic growth, it's going to be X percent or Y percent or Z percent. Everybody argued about that. And it seems to me that that term economic growth may not be the right term, because economic growth may not be shared equally across the entire economy, right? So, you know, maybe in Northern Virginia and in, you know, different pockets and cities and industries around the country, the economy feels like it's doing great. But maybe in other industries or in various areas of the country, still doesn't feel that way, right? There still is a 4-point-something% unemployment rate, and that doesn't include the people who have stopped looking for work. So the sort of unemployment rate, the broader unemployment rate, is much higher than that. So, you know, there is this thought of, you know, let's grow the economy, but maybe the economic growth that we are seeing and we have seen for the last 20 or so years, it doesn't, you know, the old saying of a rising tide lifts all boats, maybe that's not occurring. And so, yeah, it's easy to say that the economy is growing, and I just sort of said it, the economy is doing well, and that's true on aggregate, but it's not necessarily true at some of the more micro levels when you look at region or you look at different groups of demographic characteristics of people or by different industries or occupations.
I think that's a great point. Just to, you know, point out the heterogeneity of the country, it's not a single entity. There are people in industries right. that have gotten hurt more for a number of reasons over the course of the last decade. And that is manifested in, you know, the shift in policy positions of certain political parties. But on the jobs market, just something that came up recently that kind of surprised me, because you mentioned the broader measurement of unemployment. I think that's something that's, you know, important to point out, because even the 4-point-whatever percent excludes not only people who have stopped looking, who aren't even in the labor force, but a number of other different unemployment metrics that get captured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But anyways, labor force went up in the most recent jobs report and has been trending up, right? Mm-hmm. So people are actually re-entering the labor force, which, and I've heard the argument there is, that will put downward pressure on wages. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, so the basic story here is you have, let's just keep it simple, right? So you have people who are 65 and older who, you know, they work a whole career and then they retire. And maybe now some of those are re-entering the workforce because the wages have been going up. And they may be coming into, you know, maybe more part-time jobs, you know, maybe not necessarily professional jobs, they're coming in. And so what that does, because they have more experience, so employers are more likely to hire those people who have a long employment history. And so those people may come in and take jobs that might have sort of traditionally been filled by, let's just say, teenagers in this simple example, right? So you have these pressures, you know, that are playing off of each other, one group, you know, sort of pitted in some ways against another group. And so you have these interesting patterns going on, not to mention we just have a general aging of the workforce. We have still the impacts or the long-term impacts from the financial crisis of people who lost their entire life savings now have to work longer or continue to work or have to re-enter the labor market to make up for those lost savings. So the long-term impacts of the tax bill will be really interesting to see whether it encourages people to enter the labor force, which gives them more experience, which ultimately raises, you know, pushes their wages up. But, you know, I think that's sort of, you know, the second or third pass down the stream, as it were, to measure the impacts of the tax bill.
So one of the themes I'm getting from this is that and this is the precursor question that probably has a short answer to my next one. But one of the themes I'm getting from you is that your impression is that it's actually very hard even now to predict what is the impact going to be of this tax bill. Is that right?
I mean, I spent a long time at CBO trying to forecast finances of the Social Security system. It's incredibly, I mean, as you would expect, it's incredibly hard to do, right? And what you do when you do any of these sorts of models, when you do any of these sorts of projections, you base your projections on historical evidence and historical data and your best understanding of the relationship between parts of the economy. And the American economy is a huge economy, and it's part of an even larger global economy. So these things are very hard to do. Now, you know, so when someone says growth, the, you know, growth rate's going to be 1.2% next year, or whatever the number is, I sort of already in my head am building some sort of confidence bound around that, right? Like it's going to be something around that. And it's not that I don't trust the numbers. It's, you know, when the Joint Committee on Taxation or CBO or the Tax Policy Center or any of these groups who have a good reputation, who have experts, when they come out with the numbers, you know, that's really a best guess. And I don't think there's anything wrong with believing that number as long as we understand that it is a best guess, right? It is a forecast based on our historical experience. So one of the things that some of the better models are able to do is to vary some of those assumptions. So as an example, at CBO, the way the CBO long-term model works is there's one, and I'm speaking from my experience when I was there, so I'm no longer there. So from my experience when I was there, you know, there's one way in which you can run the model that'll give you sort of the answer, right? There's another way to run the model where instead of assuming a growth rate of whatever, 1.2%, you say, okay, every year, let's pull from a distribution. Let's pull from that confidence interval. So maybe it's 1.2% plus or minus 0.4 percentage points. And so in one of those runs, you get a number of 1.2, and another run it's 0.08, and another one it's 1.3. And you run that 500 or 1,000 times, and you sort of average all of the results together. And so now you're able to build, you know, a richer approach to the modeling, which is trying to bring in or incorporate some of this uncertainty that we know exists. And we know the uncertainty exists within the data itself. We know the uncertainty exists in our understanding of how the world works, in our understanding of how the actual model works, and our understanding of what's going to happen in the future. Because, another financial crisis could hit tomorrow, right? We just don't know. So yeah. It's not that I don't believe them. I just, you know, I just want to, take them all together and view them as a whole. Just like when during any of the presidential elections, and you see, I mean, I think this was Nate Silver's innovation back when he was doing 538 when he's at the New York Times. I mean,
I was just thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, his innovation was to average all the polls together, which in retrospect is like, well, duh. Right. I mean, it's like, so it seems so obvious now, but you know, when you take an average and you know, you have 10 polls and they all range between, you know, whatever, 44 and 48%. And then you have some other poll that's 34%. You start to think about, okay, so what's going on with that poll? Maybe that poll is right, but if all these other ones are in this other range, this one seems to be the outlier. So it's not that I don't believe the projections. I just want to make sure that I'm careful with them, and I just try to think carefully about what these different groups are saying, both on both sides of the aisle.
Right. And the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, they have a model, and Congress like has some rules that they actually have to work with that. But then we've got all these private models, the JCT, which is the Joint Committee on Taxation, as well as the Tax Foundation, which is a think tank. And, you know, obviously anyone can say anything they want, right? Like some news organization or Donald Trump or Paul Ryan or Nancy Pelosi can come out and be like, well, this is what it's going to do. And, you know, for our listeners that want to do a little bit more of their own research, I mean, one thing I can say is that one of the things, if you look at Tax Foundation, they'll say, yes, our prediction is different. Here are some different assumptions we used. And you can get into this awesome rabbit hole that can, right, you know, take up the whole weekend. It'll be a lot of fun. but for our listeners that want to do a little bit more research on what are the likely economic impacts and what are the, you know, assumptions behind different models and what are the methodologies behind them, where would you send them to start? Would it just be, hey, go to CBO and JCT and Tax Foundation? Or are there things that you have found to be, or places that you found to be more reliable, less reliable as places to look?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, where is the right resource? So first thing, so JCT is a Joint Committee on Taxation. So they are a congressional agency. So not a private group, they're a congressional agency, and they often work closely with CBO. So Tax Foundation is another group, Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, which is the abbreviation is CBPP. There's also, Now I'm blanking on the name. It's similar to that. There's also at Urban, where I am, is the Tax Policy Center, which is a joint project from between Urban and the Brookings Institution. I'll talk about TPC because I'm a little biased and I know the people who work there and I read their stuff basically daily because, you know, they sit down the hall for me.
What's TPC? Tax Policy Center.
So what TPC does, and these other groups do it too, but again, I'll just talk to TPC because I'm familiar with what they're doing. What TPC does is not only do they write, you know, blog posts and sort of short summaries of the score. So I'm actually looking at their macroeconomic analysis right now, which is like, you know, 4 pages long. But they also have deeper dives where they actually talk about the model, where they actually talk about, you know, how do they build it? You know, what are the assumptions that they build into it? When I was at CBO, we published a lot of papers that actually talked about the guts of the model. And actually, I remember one of my first papers at CBO was, oh man, it must have been like a 150-page paper. And talking
that's
about how
short for you guys.
Yeah, that's yeah. But you know, like 80 pages of it was just tables. It was it was like one of those papers that you know no one's gonna read unless, you know, you have nothing to do, like ever.
Or you listen to Reconsider.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Even I don't read all the tables to some extent. And that's part of the problem that you know, to some extent, like people can only do so much research. There has to be a level of trust established with, you know, there's like reputation has to be part of it, because to some extent I can't validate, this is what I do. And like, I can't validate everyone's methodology as good. Right.
No, that's absolutely right. And so what we have to do is we have to rely on others to help validate that. So, you know, the Tax Policy Center and the Tax Foundation and JCT are most often quoted because they have a track record of doing high quality work. You know, I'm sure there are other places that have tried this and have sort of flamed out because their work is not reliable or the people who are working there can't explain it. I think that's another big part of it, you know, is being able to explain the model. How does the model work? Is the head of foundation, you know, the foundation of taxes, you know, is that person able to explain how the model works? And I think that communication part is really important. And I don't think we can really be expected to wade through, you know, we being, you know, citizen Joe Schmo can be expected to wade through the ins and outs of all these complex analyses. It's just not, you know, so for me, right. So for the three of us, we're wading through economic analyses pretty regularly and it's pretty familiar to us, right? No problem. But to take it like away from our area of expertise, like I don't go sit around reading all the literature on climate change, right? I rely on the major newspapers and major medias, organizations to provide me with those stories. And you know, that's probably not the best way to go about understanding, but like, I'm not going to go try to read hundreds of studies on climate change, nor am I going to understand a lot of the jargon in there. So what do we do? I think part of it is, as I tell a lot of my students when I teach statistics, is to have your antenna up all the time. When you see a number that doesn't make sense or it's so far afield from what you might expect or what from a lot of other places are saying, that's something to consider. If it's, you know, another thing I tell my students is like when you see an outlier in your data, that is both exciting for two reasons. It's either because you stumbled on something that's really exciting and cool and new and you know, outside the bounds of what we might expect, but it could also be an error. And you should be attuned to both of those possibilities and to dive into those things. So I think what we as consumers of news and information and data need to be is just, we just need to be discerning. And of course, obviously now, especially in this time of, you know, fake news and man, I just hate using that word. That term,
post-truth society.
You know, it's just painful to have to say it, but you know, there's just so much misinformation being thrown about that it's, I think it's more important than ever for us to be at least more discerning and more alert to things that just don't feel right. And then the question is, where do you go? I think that's a big frustration a lot of people have is, okay, I see this thing, it doesn't quite make sense to me, but where do I go now? So back to your original question. If you're the kind of person who says, okay, so Group X said that the growth from this tax law is going to be, 4%, and that just doesn't seem right. Try another group. See what the Tax Policy Center says or what the Tax Foundation says, and see what information that they provide, because they both, also JCT, they provide a lot of information that explains and explores how they do their estimates and how their estimates differ from a lot of other groups.
And I'll just plug you real quick. If you even just want to, not even look at the predictions, which is a whole its own kettle of fish. But if you want if you as a listener want a really good breakdown of precisely what the personal tax income, personal income tax consequences are going to be through 2027 and beyond, I've got a link to John's blog post on that. I thought it was really good. It's data policy visualization in action, and you'll learn a lot from it. So go to the link, reconsidermedia.com/podcast, find this show.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, John, I think your point about media organizations and researchers having some degree of responsibility in learning how to communicate effectively is really important. And I would, again, to folks, go check out policyviz.com, V-I-Z, policyviz. I was reading through your blog post about, there was some chart from, I think it was Merrill Lynch, and it was a stacked bar chart. Mm-hmm. And I think something that a lot of folks encounter when they do try to actually dig their teeth in and get into the nitty gritty in the weeds is they come across a chart that just like is it kind of assaults them with information. Yeah. And if you haven't, broken down statistics since college or high school, it can be intimidating. And the thing that really stuck out clearly for me in this blog post was how representing this data differently, visualizing it in a different way, really brings out the trends that the author is presumably or was presumably trying to highlight, but just gets missed in all of the different colors and all of the different numbers. So that was cool, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
that's my question. That was cool.
Well, I'll agree. The answer to that question is it was cool.
Yes.
I spend a lot of time thinking about this, and one of the things that happens, especially with researchers, which is most of the people that I work with, both at Urban and at other places, is there is, well, a few things, but let me just sort of focus on the process, right? I think what a lot of researchers do is they get some data, they do some analysis, they run a regression, they make a graph, and then they take those tables and those figures and they put them in a Word document, and then they just write, right? And they just write around those pictures. And what really needs to happen more, I think, is the data analysis part and the writing part and the visualization part all need to be more combined into a single process, that they all work together. Deidre McCloskey, who's an economist at University of Illinois Chicago, has this great book called Economical Writing. So anyone listening to this is, sort of a researcher doing this kind of work. This is like the Strunk and White for economists is economical writing. And in the book, she talks about how the data analysis and the writing should not be sequential. You shouldn't do the analysis and then go write. They should be together, going back and forth. You know, you do a little bit of the analysis and you write a little bit and then you go back and maybe you find something else and you iterate. But she doesn't talk about the visualization part, and she doesn't talk about the presentation part, which is a whole other area to dive into. But I believe that all three of these things need to be integrated together. So one thing, so I'll just give like the one tip that I think can help a lot of people is what happens with like those Merrill Lynch graphs, right? Is it's some tool and it's, you know, Excel or whatever, and it's insert column chart. And it's like, I know how to make this chart and it's clear to me as the creator and I'll just put it out. Now we can, there's lots of ways to learn how to do that better. But one thing I think researchers can do very easily is to take the titles of their charts, and instead of the title being some non-descriptive passive thing of, you know, figure one, unemployment rate, 1950 to 2010, it can be what the point is. Like, what do you want me to get out of this graph? Or like, there's a good one. Right? Like instead of saying, like, here's a good one. So imagine a graph. We were talking about the labor force participation rate. So let's talk about that. So imagine a graph of the labor force participation rate for men and for women over time, the last 60 years. So most people would say figure one, labor force participation rate, men and women, 1950 to 2010. Right? But like, what if the title of that figure was something like figure one, the labor force participation rate has fallen for men and risen for women over the last 50 years. And you would see these two lines sort of coming together. And that's the point of the graph. And so I think that's one of like the low hanging fruit things that researchers can do, is to just think about their titles as a more active part of the graph. And that it's, this is what I want you to get out of the graph. Here it is. It's right in the words right at the top. And now you have it, and now you can go learn more about it. You can get the actual numbers and see the actual trend and dollar amounts or whatever right in the graph itself.
I think that's a great point. It seems like an easy modification. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
No, you would think it'd be easy, but alas.
Oh, it's a problem in, I'm just going to make a comment, throw it out there, and then let it go. I think it's a problem in like almost every kind of like industrial or academic field, that there is a way things are done and everyone is really afraid of not doing it the way things are done. And when I was in grad school, I saw this all the time. People would like, they would write an essay for a class and it would be great. And then they'd like get to their academic paper and it's like their brains went, I'm going to make this incomprehensible. And I'm going to make the English really weird and stupid. It's like, no, just write it.
Yeah. You know, let me see how long I can write this and put as many jargony words in there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, no, just write it so I can read it. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Change is heard. I do have a question. I want to get to the topic of debt because I know it's something we wanted to chat about. I just have one more quick remark, because the comment that you made about encouraging your students to just keep an eye out for any particular outliers, that really struck with me, because as we've mentioned here at Reconsider, we don't think that average person can, you know, there's only so much that an average person can do, even an interested average person. Yeah. So we have a set of, we call them Reconsider principles for helping approach information perhaps more skeptically, or the ultimate point is encouraging more effective political dialogue. And there's one called internal skepticism. And that really stuck out to me, because what we encourage with internal skepticism is to approach sources that you trust, even with a certain degree of skepticism. Like, obviously, like you said, you need to build a base of trust in terms of organizations that you reference. But especially with social media and the way information is presented to us on social media, it's also important to be skeptical, even of the things that you've come to trust, because they can change, et cetera, et cetera. Anyways, I thought that was a great point.
No, I think that's right on. And the other thing I'd say is that it is unrealistic for us to think that everyone is going to, you know, read a news article in the New York Times or whatever, and everyone is going to like fact check the numbers in the article, right? That's not going to happen, right? But if, you know, one person did it or five people did it, you know, right? It's just, you don't need a lot, right? If we had, say there's an article comes out from, you know, some magazine and one person fact checked it and said, well, this isn't right, or I don't think this is right. And with social media, I mean, it's one of the advantages, I think, of social media is if you are the one person who reads this article and says that doesn't look right, and you go and do the research, you know, go to the background information to find that it is not right, and then you put that out and say, hey, New York Times, Washington Post, you know, St. Louis Dispatch, whatever it is, you know, this number doesn't seem right. You know, you have that ability to share that with the rest of the reading public. So it's unrealistic, I think, for us to expect for ourselves or for the public at large to do all this research, but we don't need all of us to do it. We just need some people to do it.
Yes, totally agree. All right. Back to taxes. So
back
let's talk,
to taxes.
Let's talk debt, baby. So Tax Foundation says there's not going to be as much debt. Who said there's going to be a truckload here? I had it written down and I've totally lost it, but like an extra trillion in debt at least or something, a lot.
Yeah.
And so we're at a point right now, obviously, where debt is already at a historic high, highest since World War II. You know, as you talked about earlier, like, oh, and we have low interest rates, and those combined always worry me. But one of the things we talked about actually with Dr. Marin, your colleague, mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago is we brought up the debt thing. And one of the things he had said was like, yes, like the government has a lot of ways of raising revenue. And essentially, I think like – I don't know if, you know, it's possible that he's just confident that like, oh, when we need to, we will. And his impression was that, you know, like the issues of debt or like the biggest issue of debt is that like you get increased interest rates, obviously for, you know, for government, you know, for government debt and it becomes right. more and more burdensome. One of the things I'm wondering is that obviously before this tax bill, the GOP, one of their things was debt, too high, bad, let's cut it. And
debt.
Is obviously an aberration from, yes, this is obviously an aberration from that. But let's say the government doesn't figure out how to raise revenues and debt does keep going up. Do we have like good historical, global, et cetera, examples of what happens to a country if debt really starts to get to some, you know, some very high number? I don't know what it is, probably not 500% of GDP, but, you know, something large.
Yeah. I mean, it's Greece, right? I mean, Greece is the example. Greece borrowed too much. And it spiraled out of control. And, you know, it essentially needed to be bailed out by Germany and the rest of the EU. You know, I hesitate to disagree with Donald because, well, first off, he used to be my boss. So, you know, I have to, you know, when I was at CBO.
I'm the fool.
So, but, you know, I think I'm a believer that the huge amount of debt is a problem, is going to be a problem. So let's just, because I have it right in front of me. So Tax Policy Center, when they did their estimates of the tax law, including the macroeconomic effects, so when they factored in the growth of the economy, the projected impact on debt is going to be in 2027, $1.5 trillion or 5.5% of GDP. And that's going to go up to $1.6 trillion or almost 4% of GDP in 2037. So it's, you know, it's 5% of GDP, which is a lot. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it constrains our it constrains the government's ability to respond to economic crises, military crises, other financial crises. It constrains our ability. And I think the sort of implicit view from the government is that there's this tap of people who are willing to fund the United States that will never get shut off. And I'm not sure I buy into that. I think in general that, you know, I think debt can be used, deficits can be used to finance government activities when they need to be financed, but especially in times of economic growth, we should be working on the long-term fiscal health of the country. And we're really not doing that. Now, that being said, obviously the counter position is, well, if the tax cut is going to spur so much economic growth, we will grow our way out of that. Now, I'm not a macroeconomist enough to know what level of growth we need to achieve to get out of this amount of debt, but it seems like it's a lot. And it just, having spent a lot of time studying Social Security and the pressures that are facing Social Security, which is a entitlement program to which people are guaranteed their benefits to some extent, the pressures that are going to weigh on the federal government's financial picture are, I think, concerning. And as you mentioned, just a few years ago, the GOP was really concerned about debt. Now with this tax law, it doesn't seem to be so much. But again, their perspective seems to be, at least, that, you know, we'll grow our way out of it. And I'm just not convinced that's the case.
Mm.
It's always so much more fun to, like, you know, talk about academia than talk or like, you know, the industry as a whole than it is to, like, talk about the myriad problems that it's our job to deal with.
Right.
Well, maybe what we'll have to do then, Eric, is just have John back for a show on Social Security. We haven't done that yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be happy to. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting the actually part of Social Security that I find really interesting, and the one that I do a lot of work on, is the disability side of it, because that's the one actually that is the trust fund of the DI program is going to go broke in 2022, I believe. So that comes first. And it will be interesting to see how Congress deals with that looming shortfall.
So I think we have learned a lot about the, you know, one, just the sheer complexity of the bill we're talking about, even though we didn't get into like the many specific details, which I actually really enjoyed, because you can just read those. You can be like, oh, it did this and it did this and it did this. Right. But like, what does that mean? What are the implications going to be for individuals, for the nation as a whole, for the economy, for our debt? This is a pretty complex piece of work. And, you know, one of the things that we're not going to leave you with is whether we think it's a good thing or a bad thing, because that's not our job. That's yours, dear listener. But one of the, you know, John, you've put more thought into this tax bill than we have, because we flit around from topic to topic like butterflies. And one of what I want to do is make sure that I give you the opportunity to say, hey, in my study of this and in my work at the, you know, with the context of my work at the CBO and such, this is something I learned about it that I think is really important and informative and underappreciated. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I guess there's a few things. So let me just like quickly go back to the three big things I want to make sure that people understand about the tax bill. So the first thing is that that there's the corporate side and the income tax side. There's a big change on the corporate tax side. And I think that's something that probably for a lot of us didn't really hit home, because it's not something we have to deal with in our weekly paycheck. But that's a big thing. The other thing we talked about was big tax cuts when the economy is doing relatively well, that not only that you might want to do tax cuts when the economy is not doing so well, so you spur the economy. And by doing tax cuts when the economy is doing well, maybe we're constraining ourselves for future action. And the third thing we just talked about was the big debt. So that's going on in the future. So I think, you know, I guess for me, I would come back to the debt. Like, I just think it's a huge thing. It's, you know, it's going to expand to, you know, nearly $2 trillion later in this decade. And I think that's the thing that we need to think about carefully. It's whether we want to have a government that's running huge debts and deficits without thinking about the long-term ramifications for the country, the long-term ramifications for our elderly, for our needy, for our kids going forward, and how those large debts are going to constrain the government's ability to respond to crises and other needs in the economy and around the world.
All right, Democrats listening to the show, now that the Republicans love debt, you're allowed to hate it now. Be a debt hot school again. Make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I did come off a little bit that way, didn't I? But I didn't mean to. No, I just want to be... You know, I just want to be thinking carefully about these things. Like, it seemed like you had mentioned earlier that the tax bill was kind of rammed through.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think that's true, right? That's objectively true that they held maybe one hearing, right? And that's just not enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't have as a nation, we didn't have, I think, enough time to discuss the ramifications. Here, I'll give you a personal example, right? The tax bill was passed on like December 26th or 7th or whatever it was. I mean, when they did that, right, there was a scramble for people to prepay their mortgage, their property taxes, right? And so right. They ran this thing through, and it gave however many homeowners are out there basically 5 days to figure out how and whether to prepay their property taxes so that they could, you know, take advantage, which is not a bad thing to take advantage of the tax code. It's why we claim deductions and why we, you know, part of the reason why we make charitable deductions. You know, we take advantage of the aspects of the code, and it wasn't really done in a way that allowed American citizens to fully understand it and to fully incorporated into their daily budgets and their daily lives. So, you know, what I think I just want time to think harder about this stuff. And I just feel like things are moving so fast that we're just not hitting that pause button a little bit.
Well, I think we might have to hit a pause button until our next conversation. But John, it was really a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for coming on the show and just digging deep into some of this stuff. It was really a pleasure to be able to chat with someone with your experience at TBC and CBO. So hope you'll join us again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks guys for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Remember, all you listeners out there, don't let the pundits do the thinking for you. Pause and reconsider. We'll see you next time.
So long, everyone. Thanks again, John.
That was a lot of fun, man. I get to the end of these podcasts occasionally, because it's certainly not always. I just like want to keep talking because it's just like, oh man, right? You guys want to grab a beer? Like, let's go get a beer and talk about like tax policy.
let's just let it fly, man. Just go all.
But actually,
just go all night.
You're serious. Just talk tax policy. Come to Boston.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.